But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So at the end of this story comes the reason for the writing of this book, so that you know the signs and you have the opportunity to believe. Garrison Keillor, you know, is the host of the radio show A Prairie Home Companion. He wrote a piece called Thinking Weaselish Thoughts at Eastertide. He wrote, I had a small epiphany in church when we sang the recessional, O Sacred Head Now Wounded, a German chorale in which we basses must jump around more limberly than we're used to. A tough part compared to when the roll is called up yonder. And I stood in the rear and struggled with it. And then as the choir recessed down the main aisle and came up and stood in the side aisles, three basses wound up standing near me like border collies along the lost sheep. And I got myself in their draft and we sang our way into the barn. The moral, get with the group. Just make sure it's the right one. I came to church, Garrison Keillor writes, as a pagan this year, though wearing a Christian suit and a white shirt, and I sat in the rear pew with my sandy-haired, gap-toothed daughter, whom I would like to see grow up in the love of the Lord. And there I was, a skeptic in the hen house, thinking weaselish thoughts. This often happens around Easter. God, in his humorous way, sometimes schedules high holy days for a time when your faith is at low tide. And everyone else all around is joyful and shiny among the lilies and praising up a storm. And there you are, snarfling and grumbling. Which happened to me this year. God knows all about it, so I may as well tell you. Holy Week, he writes, is a good time to face up to the question, do we really believe in that story, or do we just like to hang around with nice people and listen to organ music? There are advantages, after all, to being in the neighborhood of people who love their neighbors. If your car won't, you can laugh. If your car won't start on a cold morning, you've got friends. A year or so, I sat down and read the four Gospels in one fell swoop, and somehow the jaggedness of it shook my faith, which maybe was based more on visuals, like Jesus tending his flock, or little children gathered at his knee, or sunbeams bursting through the storm clouds and so forth. And then I read about how the early church cobbled the scriptures together, which has to raise doubts in anyone's minds. I mean, the Jews get stone tablets, and the Mormons arranged for an angel to bring their holy text. But ours was hammered out through a long, contentious political process, sort of like the tax code, and that's something you don't care to know more about. So Garrison Keillor sat in the church service and stewed as he listened to the claims of the Christian faith and his own skepticism. And I would say the good news from the Gospel of John is that there is room for Garrison Keillor and for you and for me in the Easter story. Especially as the writer of John's gospel tells it with that very real human dimension to it, that people encountering Jesus may just not get it the first time, or the second time, or the third time, or they may get it and want to think about it, or mull it around. In fact, we humans, according to John's gospel, need multiple turns. Maybe our whole life of faith is about turning. As we heard in the Easter story last Sunday from John's Gospel, Mary turned behind to see Jesus, the Jesus of her past and their past relationship, but she was invited to turn forward to see Jesus for who he really was, this resurrected Jesus. There are all kinds of turnings in the Easter appearance stories. In each Easter episode, it seems that the community moves gradually from mourning through blindness, dabbling in fear. We see them turning in recognition sometimes and conversion. and sometimes turning to deep joy and turning to commitment to the future. And we 21st century people are invited to do that same kind of turning as well. We, like the first century Christians, are invited to turn, to see Jesus more clearly. And just like them, we are given prompts and helps to help us do that. Now, if it wasn't such serious material, I think there's a lot of comedy in the Easter resurrection appearances. We just aren't used to seeing it through that lens, I guess. So Mary realizes the gardener is really Jesus. She does what she's instructed, and she goes to tell the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And she tells them everything he said. And what do the disciples do? Yes, high fives, no. The next we hear of the disciples, they're huddled in fear in a room together. They're gathered behind locked doors because of their fear of the church leaders. But Jesus comes to them through the locked doors, and they are overjoyed. And Jesus breathes on them the Holy Spirit, and Jesus commissions them, and Jesus sends them out, and they have their first big chance to share the gospel. And they do. They tell their companion Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." Their chance for their first convert. And what happens? Their friend, their buddy, Thomas, he doesn't believe them. Here we have their first big moment, the first person to whom the gospel is spoken, and he doesn't believe. This is going to be a little tougher than we thought. So a week later, the disciples are gathered again. And Jesus, we read, comes again through the locked doors. And again he says, "Peace be with you." Then he shows himself, his wounds, to Thomas. And he says to him, "Do not be unbelieving, but believe." A Mennonite pastor told the story of a mentally ill man in their community who professed to being Jesus Christ, and after doing that, committed numerous acts of violence in the community, causing quite an uproar. When the pastor was talking to his family one evening at supper, his 8-year-old daughter said, "If somebody comes up to me and says they're Jesus Christ, I'm going to ask to see their wounds." What wisdom for an 8-year-old girl. So Jesus comes and meets Thomas, shows him his wounds, and says to him, "Do not be unbelieving, but believe." When the writer of John tells us the story of Thomas, he doesn't use any of the Greek words for doubt, but that is the tradition that we are handed down. We hear about doubting Thomas. Our translation says, Jesus said, "Stop doubting and believe," but in the Greek it's actually, "Stop your unbelief," or "Do not be unbelieving, but believing." When Jesus comes into the room of disciples and shows his wounds, we don't know if Thomas reaches out to touch them or not, but we do hear his confession of faith, his profession of faith. "My Lord and my God." It's one of the clearest and most powerful confessions of the divinity of Jesus in the entire New Testament, because Thomas uses the words "for God," and he exclaims them to Jesus. "My Lord," the Greek version of the Hebrew Yahweh. "My God," the Greek version of the Hebrew Elohim. "My Lord and my God." At the same time with that phrase, Thomas declares his belief, his obedience, his worldview, his relationship. All has changed. He has turned again. He's at a new place. Now, earlier in John's gospel, Thomas is a trusted worker. He's a trooper among the disciples. He is one who wants to know what the plan is when Jesus is getting ready to go to Lazarus' home at the time of his death. It's Thomas who realizes this is dangerous territory, and he says to the disciples when he hears Jesus is going to go anyway, "Well, let's go with him. Let's be prepared to die with him." So Thomas is a trooper. And Jesus knows this is a man who takes his commitment seriously. And he's a man who asks important questions, maybe the questions others are too embarrassed to ask, but his commitment is equal to his skepticism. Jesus knows this one who asks questions can also be an eloquent and credible witness. Well, this story is particularly touching or important to us as modern-day Christians because it's through this story that Jesus addresses us, the church of the future, and says, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now, when I read this story of the resurrection appearance to the disciples and to Thomas, I think they are multi-layered stories packed with meaning. There are so many things going on in this story, but I'll tell you what caught my attention here. And that is, maybe you noticed, and Josh referenced it, that two times in this story, Jesus greets his disciples with peace be with you. When he comes to see the disciples the first time, peace be with you. When he comes again and Thomas is there, peace be with you. We practiced this in our call to worship, right? We know that phrase, peace be with you, or the peace of Christ be yours. Such phrases are familiar to us, but what do they mean when we speak peace or we receive peace? We may think of peace as the absence of something, peace as the absence of noise, or peace as the absence of war. But for several reasons, I think the peace here, peace be with you, is a much more active reality, not just the absence of something. It can be won. It's a reality that can be forged. Peace be with you. Jesus shows himself to his frightened disciples huddling in fear. He greets them, peace be with you. And then he proceeds to send them forth, and they receive the Holy Spirit. He breathes on them. This is significant, this exchange of breath, the life force that sustains them, their breath, mingling, infused with the life force that gives him power, the Holy Spirit. And what do they receive in this sacred breathing? The authority to forgive. What do they receive in this sacred Holy Spirit breathing? They receive the authority to forgive. It's as simple as that. It's as difficult as that. Wendy Wright, in her book, The Rising, says this: "This is the miracle of Easter, that whatever is bound and chained, enslaved or unfree, can be loosened, liberated, and freed through our forgiveness. In fact," she says, "if we do not exercise this God-given capacity, our lack of action is not neutral. Without forgiveness, we hold each other bound. Without forgiveness, we cannot be free." End of quotes. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read about forgiveness, you know, I've got some examples in my life that come to mind. I've got some examples in the past of times when I've been forgiven or I have forgiven. But most likely what jumps to my mind are those relationships that are hanging in a kind of balance right now. And I know somehow forgiveness plays into it. I'm not always sure. And when I think about the struggles we read about in the news every day, I can't help but think that we spend much of our time living as bound people, as bound nations, as bound families. Our unforgiven and unhealed pain erupts into violence or sin. In November, as I heard the struggles between the Palestinians and Israelis, oh, what a legacy of pain and violence, and a sense of that being carried from one generation to the next generation. It seems impossible like life after death. And when I think of the world stage now, the various groups and factions striking to terrorize others, what a legacy of pain and unhealed violence we are living with. In a similar way, I think unforgiveness is at work in our more intimate communities, in our congregation, in our neighborhoods, in our families. Resentment or anger or grudges take hold and live on. Now, you and I know there are certainly good reasons why we may be unable to forgive another or to offer the gift of forgiveness. It is not easy to forgive, and especially if the wound is significant, it may take a long time. But what if this, the power to forgive, is the resurrection power? What if this, the power to forgive, is the power that Jesus commissions his disciples to go out with in the world? This active peace reality, this ability to forgive empowered by Holy Spirit breath. This is not, I think, forgiveness given casually as though a violation never occurred, but this is forgiveness power that can look death in the face and live. That is mighty power. Wendy Wright continues, genuine forgiveness cannot flow from one who thinks himself or herself to have been deserving of the victimization, nor can it come from one who lightly excuses a victimizer. Rather, forgiveness is more authentically given when injuries are acknowledged for what they are, and yet all involved know themselves to be capable of both injuring and being injured. Forgiveness reconfigures relationships so that they may begin at a new starting point, so that they will not repeat the past, but they can initiate a new future, end of quote. And I think this is the kind of thing that Jesus has shown in his ministry before death, and it's infused in his conversations after resurrection. He shows it in his very dying. Father, forgive them. Forgiveness is profound and difficult work. It does stretch our minds and maybe our beliefs to imagine and believe in this type of radical, freeing forgiveness that Jesus imparts with his breath. But I find it amazing that this is the commission that Jesus gives, and this is how he sends his followers. Yesterday, I was reading the South Bend Trib, and I happened to read the Annie's Mailbox advice column. And the very last paragraph was this. Dear readers, we are carrying on Ann Landers' tradition that April 2 be set aside as Reconciliation Day, a time to make the first move toward mending broken relationships. It is also a day we agree to accept the olive branch extended by a former friend or estranged family member and do our best to start over. So little did I know that Ann Landers would be preaching the gospel in the newspaper yesterday. But it seems to me that is the work of the resurrection, the work of people who follow the risen Jesus. This is what we're commissioned to do. So here on this second Sunday of Easter, Jesus breathes on us our life breath exchanged with his. Peace be with you. And we are commissioned to be people of peace, empowered to forgive others. What if we used this Eastertide season to practice forgiveness? What if we took this commission seriously and practiced this Eastertide to wield the power of forgiveness? I am intrigued by that. I want to join others in the Christian community around the world to be agents of peace and forgiveness, because this is the character of the community that lives in the spirit of the risen Jesus.